Dan Cassidy here. As we have been highlighting, we are back now with the next installment of our ongoing Portfolio Manager series right here on UBS On Air. Today's conversation, very timely, as it will focus on recent and ongoing developments around the U.S. trade policy, along with the implications to the economy, international markets. We'll spend some time on some pressing geopolitical topics, such as the ongoing Russia-Ukraine war. We'll hit on the U.S.-China relationship, among some other timely topics, top of mind for our listeners and clients. With that, we are glad to welcome back to our 1285 podcast studio here in New York, RF Joshi, portfolio manager and analyst on the Lazard Asset Management's Emerging Markets Debt Team, and has joined us a few times here in the studio before. So with that, RF, it's always great to have you. Thank you for dropping by and looking forward to our conversation today.
Dan, thank you very much for inviting me back.
Absolutely. So, Arif, our conversation today, largely a continuation of the one we had back in March. A lot of these topics are still fresh on the minds of many, and a lot has happened since March, including developments surrounding trade policy. Now, when we last spoke, the Trump administration had just announced a range of tariffs aimed at trading partners from around the world. Fast forward to now, July, much, of course, has evolved with respect to trade policy deadlines, many of them rolling in some cases, for tariff implementation. So I would be curious if you can provide us with an inventory as of this broadcast on July 17th in terms of what has been enacted and what perhaps is on the horizon of note.
Yeah, so perfect question to start us off. It has been a whirlwind 3.5 months. The presentation by the Trump administration on April 2nd far exceeded our expectations on the level of tariffs, the breadth of tariffs, the negotiations since that time have had highs and lows. And you're exactly right. You've got to look through some of the headline numbers to come down to what has actually been imposed and where do we think this is going to go. So the way I would characterize this for your listeners is there are two broad categories of countries that matter the most for the U.S. trade deficit. There's Europe, Canada, and Mexico, and then there is much of Asia. If you include current trade agreements, USMCA, with Canada and Mexico, the effective tariff rate on Europe, Canada, and Mexico is somewhere around 13%. In Asia, this is China, Japan, Korea, Vietnam as the big ones, the effective tariff rate is somewhere between 20 and 25%. And these are the types of numbers that are right in the median of what most people are expecting to be the final deal between the United States and these countries. So when you put that all together on a weighted average basis, the United States is going to end up at somewhere around an effective tariff rate of 17 to 18% when all is said and done. And that is compared to the pre-Trump presidency of around 2%. So this is a 15% effective increase in tariffs from the United States onto the rest of the world.
So in terms of how trading partners have been responding, what are you picking up on with respect to negotiations? Do trading partners seem eager to want to get deals done?
No bark, no bite.
Right.
So the trading partners all realize that they are at a disadvantage, that the U.S. has the bully pulpit of our extraordinarily large economy, that we can impose our will with regards to trade on other countries. So neither have countries responded with significant counter tariffs. They've threatened it, but generally they have not responded. And after the first couple of countries threatened responses and were met by a threat of even larger tariffs, most countries have gone silent. And so we've seen that in Europe, we've seen that in China, we've seen that even more recently in Brazil. So this is going to be a U.S.-led decision, which will ultimately be made over the next couple of months.
Now, in terms of the economic impacts being felt, it was interesting earlier this week we had the June CPI print. I think analysts were eager to examine that to determine whether we've been seeing any impact. So we had the retail sales print out this morning. So what have you been picking up on, and how have international markets investors been digesting the fluidity of this all?
Yeah, it is extraordinarily difficult to forecast. Economics 101 tells you that imposing tariffs of this magnitude is a deadweight loss, It is negative for growth for both the country imposing the tariff, and it is negative for growth for the country receiving the tariff. Jay Powell, in the last couple of Fed meetings, has also read from the academic textbooks that if you increase tariffs by 15% effective, there is revenue that comes into the U.S. Treasury, and someone is paying that revenue. Is it the exporter? Is it the intermediary buyer in the U.S.? Is it the company that buys, or is it the consumer? And what portion? And the answer to that question is we don't know. Many of us thought that the last couple of inflation prints would have shown inflation. Mm-hmm. And in fact, prior to this week's inflation number, we had some of the best inflation numbers that we've had in 12 months. Mm-hmm. I would go so far as to say that without tariffs, the Fed would already be cutting based on the very good inflation numbers. And this is what the administration has been harping on, is that ex tariffs, there is a lot of room for the Fed to cut. The Fed's response is, well, we don't know when those tariffs are going to show up. And so you ask the right question is, have we started to see it? And that's why this week's number was so important, because the answer is yes. This was the first consumer price index and producer price index print that we have seen signs of tariffs coming into the numbers. And what I mean by that is you ought to see the first signs in goods prices. Autos are extremely volatile, both new and used autos. So we tend to exclude that from the number. The CPI number of goods, inflation number for goods ex autos, month over month was 0.55% increase. That's the worst number in 2.5 years. So we got evidence that inflation is starting to show the effect of tariffs. What we still don't know, and we won't know for another couple of months, does that spread to other measures of inflation, and how long does it stick around for? And what the Fed has told us is they think it'll be around for a couple of months, at which point the market is expecting rate cuts, or we could have a scenario where it sticks around for longer and the Fed can't cut.
So as the Fed perhaps is seeking signs of trends in the coming months as they digest data, how do you see this impacting the course for monetary policy?
I view it as binary, that either tariffs cause inflation and it's transitory, to borrow a Fed phrase, in which case the Fed is going to focus on, or should focus on, non-tariff inflation. And what has gone less reported is owner's equivalent rent, which is the largest portion of inflation measured in the U.S., that's been falling nicely. And we all know why. The housing market, with mortgage rates where it is, with transactions being very low, equivalent rent has been falling. And as a result of that, yes, we see inflationary pressure from tariffs. But on the other hand, we see disinflationary prices from the biggest component. So if we find by September, October, that this is a transitory increase in inflation, I would expect the Fed to move with a 50 and continue to do 25s and bring overnight rates down from where we are today, 450, all the way down to a more neutral level, which most people think is around 3%. The contrast to that is maybe the inflation numbers not only go up over the summer, but they stick around. In that scenario, the Fed cannot cut in the second half of this year, maybe can't cut in the first quarter of next year. And remember, we have 45 basis points of cuts priced in to the curve today. We have another 40 basis points priced in for next year, and that would have to be moved out.
The White House seems to be very keen on rate cuts. The president has been very expressive on that. It sounds like a lot remains to be seen as to whether the Fed will ultimately cut rates in 2025. What are your thoughts or any concerns about Fed independence at this point? Yesterday, on July 16th, markets, a bit of a roller coaster as they were digesting headlines about that potential concern. What are your thoughts, Arif?
Yeah, so it's funny you ask that question, because I come from an emerging market perspective. Policy credibility is everything. So for the same inflation expectation in an emerging market country versus a developed market country, you have to get paid much higher yields in emerging markets, because these countries haven't had credible policy for as long as the United States has. So there's a risk premium that has to be paid when credibility gets called into question. So The United States plays by different rules than EM. It's been around a long time. It takes a lot to damage credibility. So the argument is anytime the Fed's credibility is questioned, that's bad. But you're starting from a very, very strong point. I thought the market reaction yesterday for the hour and a half that we thought Fed was Powell was going to get fired was the right one. What was the reaction? Yields went higher, especially on the 30-year, the long end of the curve. That is where the policy credibility matters the most. The dollar sunk. That is the global market saying that they're questioning policy, and stocks were lower. That is the right reaction to questionable policy. Now, that was an immediate shock. There is a long time, certainly until Powell's term is up in May. There's a long time until the White House has indicated that they would nominate a new Fed chair. So we're looking at somewhere in the fourth quarter. So there is a long time for us to see what the data looks like. There's a long time to hear who the proposed next Fed chair is. And there is a chance for the proposed next Fed chair to detail what policy they would follow. And all of those could be positive or negative surprises to the market.
Now, with respect to one big, beautiful bill that has been signed into law since you and I last spoke, a lot of complexities, a lot of scale associated with that. Any implications in particular to international markets?
Yeah. So I think everyone agrees from both sides of the aisle that the fiscal deficit is entirely too large in the United States. The fiscal plan that was passed by the Trump administration, by most estimates, increases the fiscal deficit by about 0.4%. So we're going to go from a 6.3-ish deficit last year to about a 6.7% deficit this year. And we're going to be, for the next couple of years, somewhere around 6.5. Mm-hmm. So this is a mildly expansionary budget. The hopes that DOGE and some other measures would have resulted in fiscal contraction, those hopes have been dashed. We're at large deficits as far as the eye can see. Again, the United States plays by different rules than the rest of the world. If you are in a world like we have been in for the last 15 years, where the United States outgrows its potential, where productivity is high, where capital spending is high, where the labor force expands through both national and immigration, then we can run those types of deficits. Mm-hmm. The worry and the fear is that if we're actually going to grow below potential, potential is, by the way, around 1.8%. If we're going to grow below potential, then you need to have tighter fiscal policy. Mm-hmm. And remember, the 6.6%-ish fiscal deficit, the most worrisome part of that is that's half interest. So there's a primary deficit, which is about 3.3%, and then there's the interest cost, which is another 3.3. And classic economics says that if you're running that level of interest costs, it's crowding out the private sector. It's putting pressure on the longevity of the great growth story we've had in the United States for the last 15 years. So either you need to grow yourself out of that, or eventually you've got to cut the fiscal.
Now, if we turn to geopolitics, around robin of topics of sorts, Israel, Iran, Russia, Ukraine, the U.S. relationship with China, all top of mind for many. How should international investors be thinking about these topics?
Yeah, I think the most surprising thing is if you had told me ex post what actually had happened, Israel, Iran, Russia, Ukraine, U.S., China, I think we're all surprised at how limited the market reaction was.
Right.
We would have thought that if you have a war breakout in the Middle East, that you would have a much longer effect on oil prices, on risk sentiment, on treasuries, on gold, et cetera, and you didn't. Specifically in that case, I think all of us were running from a playbook of 10 years ago when Iran was a lot more, or we thought Iran was a lot more powerful. Their response was muted at best, and it continues to be muted. Doesn't mean that'll continue, but it was essentially a one-way attack, and it was over very quickly. With regards to Russia, Ukraine, that's gotten a lot worse in terms of sentiment since the last time we talked. The last time we talked, I was a couple of days before a trip to Kiev.
Right.
I spent a couple of days there. And it was the same time that that U.S. representatives were there to negotiate a minerals deal. Right. And the thought pattern was that you were likely to get a ceasefire in the middle part of this year and an eventual end of the war at the end of this year. And that's not where we are today. So now there's really no hope for an end of the war anytime soon, and maybe we get a ceasefire in another 12 months. So that continues to be a drain on Russian resources. It continues to not allow Europe to achieve its full potential in growth. And it's another source of uncertainty around the world. But I would say this, big picture, to get the markets right, yes, you have to be cautious about the geopolitics, but this market has shown they care more about growth dynamics than geopolitics. You have to get the growth story in the United States right and the growth story outside of the United States right. And to the extent you can manage those two correctly, then from an asset allocation perspective, you can determine how much non-U.S. assets you need to have.
With respect to the U.S.-China relationship, Secretary of State Marco Rubio indicated recently a potential upcoming summit involving President Trump and President Xi Jinping. What may come of that if that comes to fruition? How do you see near term the U.S.-China relationship evolving from here?
Yeah, so I think we hit peak worries on U.S.-China in the middle of April when we threatened them with 130%-ish tariffs. And now we're talking about an economic peace deal, and a potential visit by President Trump to China. So it's moved a lot. And this is, I think, the taco trade that everyone talks about, is that there are a lot of threats, and the reality, at least so far, is a lot less worse
than that.
It's walked back. Right. And obviously, that makes the efficacy of the threats diminished. And so perhaps the administration has to actually make good on one of those threats. But to your broader question, any type of economic detente between the United States and China is good for risk. It's good for U.S. capital markets. It's certainly good for emerging market growth. We still have high levels of uncertainty around the pass-through of tariffs to inflation. We have high levels of uncertainty on Fed policy. We have high levels of certainty of what the realized growth is going to be in the United States, where consumption is in the United States, the jobs market in the United States. And as we all know, the market detests uncertainty. So what I would want to see as a risk taker is be on the lookout for economic measures that reduce investor uncertainty, and the market would reward those. Anything that goes contra to that, the market would sell off on.
Well, Arif, as always, a very insightful, productive conversation. Before we close out, any final thoughts, takeaways, anything you would want to reinforce to our listeners today?
Yeah, the big one for us is the dollar. The dollar has been in a decade-plus regime of strengthening. And again, it's the same themes we've talked about in this conversation. Actually, very good economic policies in the United States for 15 years, different administrations, that encouraged labor force growth, capital spend, and productivity. Those are the three things we always look for. And the dollar, in our view, peaked in the first quarter of this year. We've had a significant move lower in the dollar because the policies that have been announced have negatively influenced U.S. growth more than they've negatively influenced the rest of the world growth. And our view is now that that is a structural move. So we are looking for a structural depreciation of the U.S. dollar in favor of non-dollar currencies at a time when investors have their lowest allocation to non-dollar investments in quite a number of years. So to put in baseball terms, I think we're at the top of the first in terms of that trade, a while to go. And we'll continue to monitor policy to see if that can persist.
Well, Arif, very generous with your time. Always a pleasure. Thank you for spending some time with our listeners, our clients here on the podcast today. And look forward to having you back in a few months. And I'm sure we'll follow up on many of these topics. But great speaking with you today.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients, UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreement and disclosures that we provide to you about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary or ask your UBS financial advisor for a copy.